The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by Fulfill.io, the ERP built natively for e-commerce sellers. Fulfill streamlines the complexity in your business to save you time and money. From smart order routing to warehouse management, accounting to inventory tracking, they take all of your complexity and all the things that take a lot of time and manual effort and streamline them under one unified tool. Their clients range from seven-figure brands all the way through companies doing hundreds of millions of dollars per year so they can grow and scale with you. And they're the highest rated ERP in our community of private sellers, according to member reviews, scoring higher than Odoo, Skubana, Brightpearl, and yes, even NetSuite. Actually scored quite a bit higher than NetSuite. So if you want to streamline the complexity in your business, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell, the largest and most popular upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 Shopify Plus stores. Man, it is hard to get people to your store these days, whether you're doing organic or whether you're trying to get down in the muck that is Facebook ads these days with the disaster that that has become. You want to take advantage when people actually show up. And if you give people a chance, 1 in 6 will spend more money with you if you send them a personalized, targeted, relevant upsell offer, which is what OneClick Upsell makes it super easy to do. You can do it pre-purchase, post-purchase, give them lots of different options. It makes it incredibly easy, and they've helped store owners generate over $200 million in additional revenue. So if you want a slice of that and you want to get started, you can get started really quickly with them in just a few minutes, get your first upsell up and running. Check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, joined by Matthew Bertulli, who is the co-founder of Pella, which creates Lomi, an incredible food disposal waste product, as well as Pella Case, which are eco-friendly phone cases. And you know, Matthew is someone I've been following on Twitter for a while, came across this stuff, and was impressed by what he's built, impressed by some of his stances. He has a real passion for building businesses with moats, defensible moats, which we're going to really get into. And just a super cool guy, one of many people, again, Twitter for the win on connecting and kind of coming across interesting entrepreneurs and people in general. And so I thought, hey, I'd love to have this guy on, talk to him and learn what he's about and kind of everything he's doing in the space. So Matthew, thanks for coming on. This will be fun.
Yeah, man, this is going to be a blast. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So like I said, we're going to spend a ton of time talking about moats and other things. And also about you were at how you went from NetSuite, which is kind of interesting. A lot of people listening are real familiar with NetSuite, the ERP, into what you're doing now. But I thought kind of an interesting story to keep it real right out of the gates was you were 2 weeks before Christmas and you had 100 employees and you were on the cusp of not being able to make payroll. Can you talk a little bit about like where you were in your business career, what brought you to that situation? Like, tee that up for us and how you got out of that.
Well, yeah. So prior to Pella, I owned a agency or like a design development shop, right? That was my first company. You can look it up. It's called Bounteous now. We were acquired 4 years ago as part of like a private equity roll up. So it was like, I had 100 and some employees and I think the company now is like 400, 500, some stupid number. But yeah, I mean, that was my first company, right? So like I left NetSuite where I was a sales engineer, started my first company. And then that was at like the very, very beginnings of the Magento boom in the market. Mm-hmm. And I just got into that very early. And then I got lucky in that, like I knew, I got introduced to Harley from Shopify by one of my employees who actually knew Harley from like childhood school. I happened to work like that. This guy just happened to work with me. His name's Jamie. He's a great dude. So just like Montreal boys. So I got introduced to Harley at Shopify really early too, when they were first developing Shopify Plus. So like we rode the Magento boom and then we rode the Shopify Plus boom. And we were a design, like UX design development shop. So that's the context. The whole, you know, nearing bankruptcy thing. I mean, I think that happened twice in that company. Once, which is the Twitter thread you're referring to, was just like, honestly, man, not understanding how important cash is like such a classic first-time entrepreneur thing. And we had grown so fast in that business, like bootstrapped, entirely like cash flow positive, profitable. that I wasn't aware of this like term of like getting ahead of yourself, or we call it getting out over your skis, where, you know, we hired ahead of the business a little too fast and it caught us by surprise at a pretty terrible time of year, right? So like too many employees, we had some work not come in that we thought was going to come in and just got caught, like just honestly, like just really bad cash management. If I was going to just sum it up, bad cash management. On my account.
Yeah. How did you get out of it? Was it you had some payables come in, or you laid people off, or how did you get out? Because I mean, that's a brutal situation.
My brother and I were working on a deal with a government agency, like a government division of a Canadian government. And that deal kind of came in at the last minute. And, you know, if you've ever done any government work, they're a royal pain in the ass for a bunch of reasons. But one of the best things about doing any kind of work with government is they pay like clockwork. Right? Because they have the infinite cash machine that is tax money. So like, there's never a cash flow issue in government. So like, we could, you know, once we knew that that was coming in, it was like, we could actually, every single day, we knew when that money would flow in, because it was just like clockwork. Therefore, our bank was very amicable to working with us on like lines of credit, you know, other stuff.
Got it. So dodge the bullet there. And you've got this kind of interesting perspective of having run both an agency, a large agency, as well as a large e-commerce business. I believe you're, you know, probably 100 plus employees right now. And agencies, I feel like they get a bad rap in terms of they're hard to sell. People say they are, but you obviously exited to private equity, which is kind of, tell me if it's unusual. It seems unusual to me on the agency side. Having done both, do you like the e-commerce model quite a bit better? Are those kind of common stigmas for running an agency true or not necessarily?
They're true. I mean, for sure they're true. Like agency, like service businesses in general. So forget agency for a second, but like service in general it's difficult in that like you're kind of always on. And I think the whole like they're hard to sell comes from most service businesses become very, very founder dependent, right? Like if you lose the key guy or guys, gals, whatever, that the clients go with them. So like there's this perceived risk with acquiring one of these types of businesses. That's what actually makes them hard to sell. So the only way to really sell agency, right, is to get to some reasonable amount of scale. So the rule that we were always told was 10 and 2. So like you needed to be at least 10 million in revenue with at least 2 million in EBITDA. Because then at that size, you probably had like proper management, you know, systems and processes, playbooks, like you had something worth buying. In our case, where I think we got lucky, if I'm being completely honest, was we were a predominantly Canadian company in our staffing, but all of our business was largely American. And what that meant was like when we sold the company, we were a really great add-on from a people and a talent perspective to what this private equity group was doing, right? Which is like they rolled up 3 or 4 development shops. And our cost base in Canada relative to US dollar revenue is lower. So it was a good add-on. Like it made sense in that way. And the other comment, by the way, like what's easier, better, brand or agency? Honestly, I say this all the time. Like you're going to eat a shit sandwich no matter what. Like neither one of them is like, there's no grass is greener thing here. They're both very different and they both present good and bad. You know, I'm having a lot of fun doing what I do now, but I also had a lot of fun building the agency too.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes is, if you don't have a hard part to your business, you don't have a business, which is the perfect segue into moats. And you've got a big passion of yours. Before we get really deep on kind of the 7 facets of moats that you try to think about when you're building a business, let's give people a sense of Lomi, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but the main product that you spend the most time on.
Yeah.
Can you give people, how do you describe it? When you meet someone at a cocktail party, and like, what do you do? It's true for everyone in e-commerce, but especially when you create like, you know, kitchen countertop, waste disposal, composting machines. I'd love to hear your elevator pitch.
So it's funny. It's like it's like we call it the world's first smart waste device, which immediately people are like, what is that?
Do I poop in a can? Like what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's such a weird thing, man. Like, I mean, look, it's the technical thing that we sort of led with was like, it's a kitchen countertop composter. And what that really means is it takes your food waste and turns it into dirt. Like that's the elevator pitch, right? So like most people, most homes in America, like 50 to 70% of your garbage every week is organic. It's food. And so like there's two problems. Number one, it smells and it attracts flies. And it's not a pleasant experience in the home. And you have to throw out a lot of garbage. Number two is it's like probably the number one thing that individuals can do to help fight climate change is like to just prevent their food waste from going to landfill. So we had this like, Lomi is just this nice double whammy of it adds comfort and convenience to your life as a person and as a family. And like your kids are going to love it. It's going to be the coolest party trick you ever do when you have people over is show them what you do with your garbage. And then at the same time, you feel really good about like you're helping the planet, right? So like I usually tell people like when I get on TV or something, it's, you know, people are like, what's Lomi? I'm like, it's a magic dirt machine. That's usually the like first thing I say. And that ensues like, you know, then people are like, what the hell does that mean?
I mean, it creates, you've got one behind you of people who are, most people are probably listening to the podcast. Yeah. I'd say it's the size, maybe slightly larger than a bowling ball.
It's like an espresso machine. Yeah. Like think of like, you know, like automatic espresso machine, you know, it's, or like a four slice toaster, you know, it's about that size. Like it's a decent countertop appliance.
And you put stuff in there and then you press the button in your organic waste and it takes, I mean, what is it? An hour, 2 hours?
It's like 3-4 hours for the shortest cycle. You know, if you're a gardener, we have like a grow mode cycle where it'll run overnight. So it'll take like, you know, 14, 15, 16 hours, which is like lower temperatures. It just produces a healthier output. So that's the funny thing. Like the very cool thing with Lomi is it's taking your food waste and it's turning into something that you can just sprinkle on your lawn as like an organic natural fertilizer, right? Or you can add it into your garden beds or your plants. Like it turns waste into something pretty valuable, you know? So for people who are into that sort of thing, like if you have a lawn, it's kind of a cool thing. Like you have a place to now throw your garbage without actually throwing your garbage on the lawn, which would be weird.
Yeah, it's super cool. So you sell the agency. I'm guessing you've got a little cash to fund something going forward, but you did an Indiegogo for this. So what's the, I mean, and maybe even before this, you know,
we're actually venture backed too. Like that's the funny thing.
I thought it was completely on the indie. Okay. So how did you kickstart this whole process? You get out of the agency and you obviously have a very strong passion towards environmental causes. And so this was of course marrying those two. So how did you go from that to why go indie if you were venture backed and when did the venture back come into it, before or after the
indie? So we raised money. So if you go way back, I mean to 2018. So we were at that time, like, so when I left when I sold my company, I immediately came into Pila. I was the first outside investor into Pila, right? And at that time, when I invested in this company, there was no revenue, but we had this Jeremy, the founder, the inventor, he had created this compostable phone case. And that was like our first commercial product. So like I came in and I'm like, okay, that's really cool material science. I want to invest. Let me help you build a brand around this. So we did that I invested in 2017. We spent a year and a bit kind of like finding product market fit. That business just took off, right? Like it, and that was bootstrapped at the time. So it went from like zero to I think $7 million in a year and a half. And then it jumped again to like 15, 16. So like it just kept going. So, and at that time we were starting to think about Lomi. We were like, the idea was, okay, so we make this compostable phone case, but people don't really have a place to put it, right? And we started talking to all of our, like we have 1.2 million customers in the Pila case business. So like you start to get a lot of feedback from customers on like, what are they missing from their life? And we had this aha moment where we're like, if Tesla can put a gas station in your garage in the form of that little home charger, why can't we do the same thing with garbage? Like, why can't we take something that has had no innovation in the home, which is your trash, and do something cool there? And actually deliver some innovation. That was kind of the moment we were like, there's no way we can bootstrap this. Like we can't go from a phone case company to a technology company to a platform company on our own. Like there's just the R&D on Lomi alone was millions, right? So we raised a Series A in 2018 small, like $5 million Canadian. And then we recently raised, and we've raised more money since then. I think we recently closed out our Series B. So the, and in, along the way, we decided to do a crowdfund, an Indiegogo for Lomi. That was a pure marketing stunt. That was nothing.
You guys raised like $7 or $8 million on that, didn't you?
Yeah, it was big. It was like 45 days. We sold, like $7 million worth of product. But, you know, I think that for people listening to this, the context there is I also spent like $300,000 leading up to that launch on lead gen and priming the pump. Right. So not everybody can do that. You know, we were an existing business. We were doing like $25 million a year at that time or something around there. So like, you know, real business, had resources, had some venture backing. We knew Lomi was going to do well. I didn't know it would do that well in full transparency. Like we had no idea that the product market fit would hit that well. And it's been nuts since then. But like, that's kind of the backstory, right? It was, you know, bootstrapped first, then venture, then crowdfund, then more venture. That's the like point form. How do we capitalize?
And at this point, you've been doing it for, let's call it 4-ish years. Is the business profitable at this point, or are you scaling your profitability? Where are you guys at on that cycle?
This year, yeah. I mean, so I think this year we're pretty close to break even, maybe a little bit profitable. Really depends on the next 4 weeks. It's crazy how much the year comes down to like Black Friday through Christmas. And it ebbs and flows though, man. Like I have months where we like really lose money. And it is just like the most, as a bootstrapper, nothing pisses me off more than when I lose money in a month or in a quarter. It's just like in my DNA, like I just don't love that. But at the same time, I don't know about you. And I mean, you've seen so many businesses, but like it takes us 3 years to develop a machine like Lomi. Like 3 years. And so like now I have product that we're developing for 2025 right now. So the development cycles eat a lot of cash short term while you're, and then we have this extra crappy problem, which is like, I'm literally building a category. So most people have never even heard of a product like this. It's not like I showed up and said, hey, I got a new type of pair of socks. Right? Like that's easy to understand for most consumers. We have to educate and entertain and like show them why they're going to want one of these in their home. So those two things, right? Super long product development cycles plus building a category, those eat cash.
And you love this. Like you love the innovation, you love the moat building. And if you can get it right over a long time horizon, it's the best type of business or one of the best type of businesses you can have. But also, like, if you look at the hit rate on it, I would guess, like, if you took a large sample size, the number of people that go out and take a 3-year cycle and try to create a category, like, we could be talking about like a 5-10% success rate, right? Like, that's maybe a little higher, but the odds are tough.
Yes. I think that category creation is how you take moonshots. It's how you build, I think it's how you really build big, important businesses that have real impact. I do not think it's for everybody. I think, you know, myself and Brad and Jeremy, like my two co-founders, like Brad and I have both built and sold companies before. So I think we're coming at this from a place of extreme privilege in that we have personal safety nets, right? And so like we're taking a moonshot because I feel safe in doing so. And I think that like that should never be lost on people. You know, if I'm starting over again, I'm definitely not going out and taking a moonshot. Like that's lunacy. Like it's stupid. But you know, if you can, and if you're in a position to do it, I also think it can be the most rewarding kind of business to build, where you get to create a category from scratch, which means like, think of it this way, Andrew, we get to show people how the world currently is, and we get to introduce them to a future state that they didn't even know was possible. Had no clue was like, they just didn't even know, right? It's the classic Steve Jobs thing. Like everything in our life that we know to be true is because somebody at some point said, hey, by the way, this is what the future is going to look like. You know, so it is a lot of fun to kind of build that kind of a company. You get to dream a ton, man.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at E-Commerce Fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is
It's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people. If you're in e-commerce fuel, our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into to avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us. ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7 or 8 figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right, back to the discussion.
Yeah, well, it seems cool. I used to think, I started out my career, and I've said this before on the show, but just complete e-commerce mercenary, just looking for opportunities 100% and, you know, kind of eschewing passion is, because a lot of people build great, you know, try to build business around their passion and it fails. But I feel like in the last 3, 4, or 5 years, passion has become more of a competitive advantage once again, as like marketers and brand owners are talking directly to people as advertising is getting more difficult. And when the infrastructure, the marketing, the eyeballs are getting harder to hack, passion actually really can help you connect with people better. It can give you drive and give you longevity, which is a huge part of success. So I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me like what you're doing with the brand, because you care about it deeply, both from the product side, but also from the mission side, like it's pretty safe to say you're having more fun this time around than you did on the agency side.
Yeah, for sure. Because there's like a more of a personal alignment. Like, so in the agency world, like I'm a software engineer by trade. So I really love just like building and tinkering. That's just like, that's personally, I just like to build stuff. That's probably why I enjoy this so much, but then also personal value alignment. Like I'm an avid outdoorsman. I mountain bike, I backcountry ski. I do all the things outside. I live in the mountains. So personally, for sure it aligns. I think you're hitting on a really important point though for brand building. And you're right. Like the last 5 to 10 years of D2C e-commerce has been largely around arbitrage on Facebook traffic, right? Or some kind of paid traffic. I actually think the next 5 to 10 years, brand building is going to become very important. And I know this is going to drive performance marketers nuts. And I am one, by the way. Like I'm a very hardcore DR guy. I think that brands that have something to say have an incredible competitive advantage. Right? Like they don't need to talk about their product. They have something to say. You know, they speak to an audience that is passionate about that subject, whatever that subject is. And I think when you look at the great brands of today, the Yetis and the Lululemons, even the Vuori's, like these companies have something to say and they can continue to go back to that. And I believe that D2C and e-commerce brands, like smaller ones, could learn a lot from those playbooks and having a point. I call it a point of view. Like you need to have a point of view on how the world is and how it should be. And that's brand building.
Yeah, I was looking at, I'm sure you're familiar with Rivian, the electric truck maker. And I was on their website this morning. Well, there you go. So you're like, this is perfect. I feel like I was looking at their website this morning and just appreciating how well the Tesla is an amazing company. I have a lot of respect for Musk and what he's done with Tesla. But in terms of the brand that they are intentionally fostering at Rivian, I think they're doing a much better job because they've said, one, they have a, ones they have like a great, you know, their purpose is, hey, we're trying to, you know, save the planet, which is a noble purpose. You kind of understand that. But secondly, they're very niching incredibly down to saying, we're building electric adventure vehicles. Like that is their market. All of their messaging, all of their copy, all of their videography, their website, even the features that they have. Like I, you know, have grown up and spent a lot of time in mountain towns like yourself. They've got a feature where, you know, they're thinking about the animals. There's a million dogs running around ski resorts or mountain towns, right? And so they've got a feature on their screen where if it gets hot, it says in really big letters, like, hey, the cab is air conditioned for this dog. Don't break the window kind of stuff. They're thinking about this. Anyway, so
yeah, I feel like they've done. Like, think about it. They indoctrinate. They're building.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. I mean, what was it that made, you've got one on reservation. What made you reserve one? Was it I'm guessing it wasn't just the tech. You could get a Cybertruck, you could get an F-150 Lightning. What was it?
So it's funny, as I have an F-150 Lightning now. and I had a Tesla. I had a Model S for 7.5 years before I got the Lightning. So I've been like on the EV train for a while now. And I love it. I mean, I just love not going to gas stations. That's my favorite feature of EVs. Is not going to gas stations. Just like that little bit of time, you know, really makes me happy. But Rivian, I fell for the, like the messaging. So I saw myself in their vehicle, in their marketing, you know, that like, this is people, you know what it is like when you're building a brand, it's like people like this do things like that. And I was basically Rivian's people like this. And I did things like that, that they were showing in all of their marketing. So, and the only reason I have a Lightning is because I put a deposit down on both, on Rivian and the Lightning. And I'm like, whichever one shows up first, I'm getting. And then I'll just wait to see the other one. You know, what, like, that's kind of what we're doing. And my wife might take the Rivian when it comes in. So yeah, I think they're a great example of like what it's like to just build a cult and just like indoctrinate people into that. It takes time. You got to kind of like, you got to be patient. You have to marry this kind of work with great performance marketing, because like performance marketing provides like today fuel and building a cult provides tomorrow fuel. And I think you need both. I don't think you can just do one or the other for very long.
Do you think it's how much harder is it to build a really aspirational brand? You've built one, Lomi, you were talking about Rivian. When you're bootstrapping, most of the people listening to this podcast are bootstrapped. I'd say 95% of them are bootstrapped. And the other 5% are not. Maybe, but even those, you know, the number that have venture-backed funding are very, very low. It's probably friends and family or other things like that. How much harder do you think it is to build an aspirational brand? Because Rivian, I mean, they've got tons of venture-backed money. You know, they're probably, I'm totally guessing here, but they're not going to be profitable for years, I would guess. But they have the funds to build those assets, to hire world-class creatives, to think about those things. That's so much harder, even if you're talented on a bootstrap level. So I think it's still possible. Well, it's still possible, of course, but how much hard is it insane boss mode, or is it possible if you focus on the right things?
I think it's super possible. Look, I'll give you like, if I was to start over again right now, and there are brands that are doing this, by the way. Have you seen Isaac from the katana sword thing? That
oh, yeah. Do you see? I don't know if you can, hold on a second.
It's brilliant. Like his marketing is crazy, right? It's all organic. It's all freaking YouTube. There you go. Like you're one of those people. That's hilarious. So look, I think, you know, and he's just like one example. I think like Dave Asprey did it with Bulletproof Coffee. So I think if you're a small bootstrap businessman, what I would be doing is I would be like getting out in front of that as the individual behind that business. You know, and I think that this is a missed opportunity with most brands is there's no freaking faces in D2C. Like it blows me away at how many brands are faceless and nameless. Ezra did this with Boom, right? With Cindy, like they had a face and people can connect with that. And you absolutely can build sort of like your own little cult, whatever size or scale that you want that to be. But I think that too many founders in D2C for too long, we relied on the wrong things and we stopped getting out in front of our brands. And that is actually how brands are built. Like Lululemon, like Chip Wilson, that was a bootstrapped company for a long time. Long, long time. before they got private equity involved and did the whole thing. But like they kind of like snuck up on the world for years and just built this crazy cult. I think Arc'teryx is another one that came out of Vancouver that just has like crazy loyal following. So there are examples everywhere. They're just not your common ones that you would see on like Twitter or get covered by like mainstream D2C news. But I think there's so many that bootstrap brand founders can learn from. And I don't think it's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to maybe we can dive into those two just a little bit more. This whole brand thing, I think is fascinating. Let's do Arc'teryx. Cause we'll keep the mountain sports theme going. Yeah. I'm familiar with them more than Lululemon. So Arc'teryx, you know, for people who aren't familiar, extremely high end, probably the highest. And
dude, it makes Patagonia look cheap.
Good way to frame them up. Patagonia, you're like $300 for a down vest. Watch this, right? Like hold my beer. So what do you think is it about Arc'teryx that makes them so, like, they've got a good product, right? But they don't, their product isn't twice as good as Patagonia, right? Like it's just not. What do you think is that makes them so good that lets them command that premium price point that has allowed them to build such a strong brand?
So they, word of mouth, like, let's just talk like, I mean, like it, when we talk brand, we're talking about word of mouth. It is the best form of marketing. So if you're a mountain sports person, right, particularly winter mountain sports, so like skiing, backcountry, snow, all that stuff, climbing in particular, Patagonia did this too. If you are one of those people, the key with Arc'teryx's stuff for listeners is if you're one of these people that spends a lot of time out in the backcountry, you can't have your gear fail ever, right? Like, if your jacket or your pants fall apart when you are out skiing in the backcountry, you die. You can't have anything fail. So what happens is Arc'teryx makes a product that's great. And is it like 10 times better than Patagonia? No. But the community of those people, you talk. And when you talk about reliability of stuff in that particular sport, it matters a lot. So the word of mouth becomes really, really powerful. Like I had a friend here locally who moved out to British Columbia last year with his family. And he sent me a message a few weeks ago. He's like, I need to get new gear, like jacket and mid-layer for this winter. What do you recommend? I didn't even blink. I'm like, Arc'teryx. And I sent him links to the products to buy. I'm like, here's your setup. You don't even have to think. And that is just like, because I'm a fan of the product. Like I have hit trees skiing at like 50 miles an hour and broken a rib and the jacket was not a scratch on it. You know? So like those stories are what I tell people when I'm an advocate for that brand. That's a freaking cult, man. Like that is like word of mouth at its finest. And I think that there's brands in every category that do this. Arc'teryx is just the one that comes to mind for me because I'm a mountain hippie.
Yeah. Do you think it's more though, they've got a great product, and those kind of stories and word of mouth happen from, or just naturally from great products, right? Like you buy it and you have it, but it seems like there's something more to that in terms of how they position themselves in terms of, you know, I mean, there's more to it than just the product. I feel like
their
product, there's lots of companies out there with
everything, man, their words, their visuals, like it all reinforces that, like, you are this kind of person when you buy our product, right? Like it just, they don't even try to appeal to not that kind of person. Like that's the funny thing. Like and there's all these, like when I moved from Toronto to British Columbia, I could see the cultural shift from East Coast to West Coast, right? It's like going from New York to LA. Like the first time, like, I used to spend a ton of time in New York and then I started spending a ton of time in LA. I'm like, this is a different country. Culturally, it's not even the same. I know you're the same country. I get that. But like, it's a different country. So but these brands, and I think this is another thing, we can go into the whole local thing, but like, I think that these brands do such a good job with speaking to their, like this one customer. It's like every piece of creative is for one person. You know, it's for like that one type of person and they're just like, they're anal about it. We do it. Like I kind of ignore everybody that's not my core customer, you know, and I tell my whole team that I'm like, when you're talking to a customer, I want you to think like, is this our person? you know, treat them accordingly. Like if they are our person, treat them like they are just the gift to the business, because they are. Like that person will tell everybody they are an advocate. Now, if they're not, you know, like the average age of a Lomi customer is like 46. You know, most of our customers are between 35 and 60. So when I get a customer come along that's like 24, that's an outlier. You know, like we don't speak to that person. That's not our core. We're not even trying to get them.
Hey, Andrew here, the quick aside. So this episode went long and we took a hard right and started talking about moats, as I kind of teased at the beginning of the episode. And we're going to be picking up the conversation next week on the podcast. The next part was probably my favorite part of our discussion. We're going to be getting into 6 or 7 tactics for building real defensible moats in your business. Some that are more powerful and not as hard to build as you might think. Was really impressed with Matthew's thoughts on all these. So join us next week for the remainder, when we'll be coming back to geek out about all things business moats. Given you've made it to the end of the episode, there's a pretty good chance you're fairly serious about this e-commerce stuff, which is why you should check out the E-Commerce Fuel community. It's a vetted, vibrant community for 7- and 8-figure brand owners. And joining gives you access to a lively discussion forum for experienced founders sharing insights and getting help. Access to our library of over 20,000 member reviews on everything from agencies to tech to lawyers to all the things that, you know, founders are making hiring decisions or purchasing decisions on to run their business, and invites to member events throughout the year. So if that sounds interesting, you can apply for membership and learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Big thanks to One-Click Upsell from Zipify Apps. Rapidly increase your AOV by offering targeted, high-converting upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And also to Fulfill.io, an ERP designed specifically to streamline complex e-commerce businesses and the highest-rated ERP among our community members. Learn more at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network, live from New York.